You're listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast from the Modern War Institute at West Point. I'm John Spencer, Chair of Urban Warfare Studies at MWI and host of this podcast. Hello, listeners. Today we're going to do something I wouldn't say different at this point, but I want to talk to you about what I've learned about October 7th. So at the time of the release of this, I just got back from visiting Israel, Gaza, Khan Yunis, the north of Israel. I've been studying the Israel-Hamas war, but I also have been studying, as you know, if you're a listener of the show, I cover everything from terrorist attacks in cities to civil security to understanding cities, to understanding large-scale combat operations in cities. And if you look back, actually, and I actually recommend, if you remember, I went to Mumbai in 2018, walked the ground of the Mumbai terrorist attacks from November 26, 2008. They actually call it 2611. Analogous to 9/11, it's the India's 2611 or their 9/11. If you go back and listen to that, actually, there's a lot of unique characteristics to that attack. And we went to Mumbai, we walked the ground, every site, and the detail of the planning that went into that, which was a Pakistan ISI orchestrated Pakistan terrorist attack on Mumbai, a major mega city in India, and 10 terrorists brought down the mega city and held sites for over 3 days. But there's, you know, a lot of similarities. So I recommend going back to that episode where I think I called it Learning from the 2008 Mumbai Attacks. Very interesting case study of basically a terrorist overloading the city as a system. But now I've been studying the horrific attack of October 7th, the worst massacre of the Jewish people since the Holocaust. It's horrific. I think it's important. So that's what I've been studying. I was there in December, and I just got back 2 weeks ago, so two trips. And I started off actually by watching the video. So the video that the Israeli government, IDF, and others put together, the 47 or 45 minute version. I saw it in the Israel consulate in New York. It shook me. I don't recommend anybody watch it ever. I actually wrote an article, and I'll put it in the show notes, but I wrote an article for Soldiers Magazine on what I saw in the video, the carnage that I saw. But even, again, I'm studying this from an urban warfare studies perspective, so I also look at it through the lens of who I am, an urban warfare scholar. So even in watching the video, I was looking at the military features of it, not just the carnage, the Jeffrey Dahmer psychotic carnage that the terrorists were filming, because that's what the video is. Just to be clear, the video that the IDF put together is mostly Hamas GoPro footage that they had all instructions on to capture every moment that they could. And I'll talk about the books that they had, but they had books on that included how to wear their GoPros and how to record the sick things they were doing. And in that article, I describe what I saw. A lot of the scenes that still shake me, but also as somebody who's led soldiers into combat on attacks, the glee that was in the Hamas terrorists who conducted the October 7th attack, I had never seen anything like that, not in my soldiers. It was very revealing, very shocking how happy they were riding on their trucks, heading in into Israel. And I think that gets to, what do you call October 7th? I've heard October 7th called a terrorist attack. You know, like the Mumbai terror attack. But I actually don't like that, because while Hamas is a terrorist organization that's been designated as such by the United States, United Kingdom, and many other countries, who does employ terrorist tactics, I mean, surely the act of October 7th had many elements of terrorist in it, where their intention is to inspire that fear in others and have the fear being a big part of the strategy. But what was done on October 7th was also a division level attack. I don't say that using it loosely. Division over 10,000 soldiers, a organized military formation. If you look at the number of Hamas terrorists that crossed Israel's border, around 4,000, you add in the number of people who firing the rockets, who are doing the command and control. This was a division level invasion of Israel by a terrorist army, by an army who also is terrorist. So I call it the October 7th Hamas attack. Others have tried to argue with me that it's a raid, because a raid, as you know, is an attack with a planned withdrawal. I don't think so. And I'll explain to you, as I explain some of the things I've learned, why it doesn't fit the raid definition that I would have taught when I was a Ranger instructor in Ranger school, because there was no planned withdrawal. They actually had intentions of staying, although many of them did withdraw back with hostages, but that wasn't the intention. I don't think that was the plan, but let's talk about it. So I started my research by watching the video. Go look at the article. It's horrible. It shows you. It's also broken up to locations, and I'm going to talk about a few locations. One of the reasons why the video is so shaking is that it's told through many points of view. So you basically start off by watching Hamas riding across the border in their trucks, smiling, singing. It's crazy. And then it takes you to different scenes, and it tells you what scene it is. Far Aza, Nova Music Festival. And it gives you the point of view from the Hamas GoPro, but then it'll show you the Hamas shooting at the car, and then it'll flip to the car's dash camera. Or it'll flip a couple seconds to the scared Israeli civilian in the car with their phone, and then the terrorist walks up to it. It's so eerie, the collection of points of view that they do to show you the scene and the horrible things that are happening. And then it's flashing the photos of those people burned alive in their vehicle, or the children laying on top of their toys, or the burned families holding each other. Like the video incorporates all those, but in a certain time and space that is shaking. The bodies of the raped women with their legs broken and disfigured in a way only could be done through a lot of violence. And it's just awful. But I started my research with the video, and then I traveled to Israel back in December, where I went to Far Aza, which I'll talk about, which is one of the kibbutz. So a kibbutz in Israel is especially in southern Israel, but there's some in northern Israel. They're small communities, like farming communities, that are social. They share income. They share the things in the community. So just think a farm community that share resources. And there are multiple of these kibbutzim or kibbutzes along what they call the Gaza envelope, or southern Gaza, that skirts besides the border between Israel and Gaza, the Gaza envelope. And that, I actually wrote an article about that visit as well, but I'm going to talk about it. But go read my Time magazine article about Far Aza. During that visit, I also went to the Erez humanitarian crossing point that was targeted. And then I crossed into Gaza and went to the big tunnel that was found about 400 meters north of the Erez humanitarian, or not north, into Gaza. So into Gaza, the big tunnel. And I put photos up of that if you're interested. And what I saw in that tunnel, multi-million dollar invasion tunnel. But that was the extent of the October 7th. And I did some interviews, IDF, police on that trip. On this last trip, I expanded it. I have some really close connections in the Israel police. This time, I spent a lot more time with them walking Sarot. It's a city in southern Israel, Afakim, the Nova Music Festival site as well. But I spent a whole day with the IDF command, basically command historian, but in charge of the historian branch, walking the site, like actually like point to point to point. And they've done a video documentary of one of the sites, which is really analogous to the Tradoc Army University video documentaries, which I highly recommend. But they've already put one together of Afakim, which is one of the farthest east city that Hamas was penetrating. Okay, let's go through the attack. Now I'm gonna, this is the start of the research, but because the attack was so extensive, it's not like the Mumbai attack, which I did write some lessons from. There's been some great reports from that. To write the October 7th case study will take a lot of visits, because each site, it's its own battle or a massacre site, or you're just a site of carnage, and we'll get into that. But I'm going to share with you what I've learned so far, because I think some people, even in Israel, don't know the extent of it. Then, of course, they're because of their proximity, because of they know somebody was involved in some way, or they all were involved because of the rocket and the, I'm not going to put up the figures of what the equal to this is in the 9/11 terms, but it's like equal to 40,000 Americans being killed in a single day just by population ratio. But let's get into the actual day. So on October 7th, which was a Saturday, which is a Shabbat, a Jewish holiday, but it was also it was also a Jewish holiday. So there were, just like any military installation, there were a reduced amount of forces on this holiday. A lot of the villages, they have tents that they'll set up on the outside of their houses for this holiday and for Shabbat. And they have this, and then for this holiday, they had these tents that they set up on the backside of their houses. And they ended up being the scenes of a lot of awful things. But it's basically 6:30 in the morning on a holiday, October 7th, which is also the 50-year anniversary of the Yom Kippur War, and there are some other dates that aligns with, who knows how Hamas chose this day. But 06:30, the day opens with a massive rocket barrage coming out of Gaza. And it isn't abnormal for Hamas terrorists in Gaza to launch rockets at Israel civilian sites, all war crimes. But this barrage was unique. Within the first few hours, Hamas launched 3,000 rockets. And that was the first sign to everyone in Israel that something was wrong, because they have an alert system, and the alert system went off as these rockets were targeting everywhere. Tel Aviv, all of the southern Gaza sites, many villages, but it's just about every phone is going off. Sirens are going off. If you live in the Gaza envelope, that southern portion of Gaza, every house is required to have a safe room, which we'll talk about, but it's a bomb shelter. So 6:30 in the morning, alarms got off, rockets incoming. They know they have a couple seconds to get to that room in their house or right outside their house. That is the safe room. It's basically a bomb shelter. But that's the start of the day. This massive, massive rocket barrage. And then the attack also targets all of the border fence, which is this very large fence that has a very technological aspect to it. It goes deep underground to prevent tunnels, has sensors all over it. Hamas waves of attacks, and I'll talk about the waves, start attacking not just the fence itself, but any camera system, which was a part of the technology package, or any roving force. There's a lot of reconnaissance done for this. So they immediately blind the border, basically. So they blind all the sensors, all the cameras, using drones with munitions, rockets, direct fire attacks, everything. And they blind and overload the security forces and the system that is the security between Gaza and Israel, in southern Israel. And then they breach the fence. So they use initially, basically, what we would call shape charges, like door charges or charges that you would use, like a almost like improvised Bangalore torpedoes. Like improvised Bangalores that are set up in a square pattern that actually mimics an Israeli system to punch holes in things. But they start using those to breach the wall. And there are 22 different breach sites. Eventually, there's some photos and some videos of them driving construction equipment, bulldozers or caterpillars and things like that up to the fence to punch, make bigger holes. But the breach starts, and then they start attacking the defenses of southern Israel. So this is, they move straight for the any military installation that they haven't already blinded along the way. And one of them really important, the Gaza Division headquarters. They head straight to this because Israel, like, you know, like other places, is cut up into geographies. For the defense forces, it's called the Israeli Defense Forces. The country is cut up in Northern Command, Central Command, Home Front Command, and Southern Command. So the Southern Command, and within the commands, you have different divisions, and there's a Gaza Division responsible for the, you know, the Gaza area. And the Gaza Division headquarters is attacked immediately. The Sirot police station of the closest city, basically to the edge, is attacked. There's some interesting mystery on whether the Afikam police station was supposed to be attacked and they missed a turn or not, which I'll get into. There's a debate kind of that the Hamas that were sent to that place missed the turn and didn't hit the police station, or no, they're meant to go straight into the actual, homes, the apartment, you know, basically into the homes. But either way, so they attack the defenders, basically any defensive site in southern Israel, to overload it again. This is all like in a matter of the first 30 minutes. So it's a division level attack. There are three waves that I'll get into when I walk you through what's going on at Faraza, one of the kibbutzim, literally a couple hundred meters from the border. But there's three waves. You have this kind of Hamas special forces, Nukba, their elite force that's doing all the first wave of attacks. They're taking out the security forces, the attacking of the small army bases that I had been to. I'd been to many of these in 2018, 2021, when I was over there studying Israel's urban warfare and subterranean warfare. I even drove a D9 bulldozer way south at one of these places that gets overrun, unfortunately. But this, so there's three waves of attacks in this division level attack. You have the Nukba special forces. Behind them, you have like a Hamas reserve infantry. And then behind them, you have this militia scavengers / civilians turned into combatants that we'll talk about by these three waves. Now, let's talk about what they brought with them, all the three waves, especially the first two waves, the Nukba and the Hamas reserves, because I actually went to one of the bases and toured all the equipment. Some people may have seen some photos of it, but the equipment in which the terrorists, who also are a part of a military force, Hamas brought with them. So they brought a full range of small arms, anti-tank, so AK-47s, everything really, from North Korean weapons, Soviet, Russian, Israeli weapons that they had taken from the people that they killed, RPGs to include a tandem round that they made themselves, shape charges that they used, you know, to do all the breaches, large ones, anti-tank mines, like hundreds and hundreds of, like each pickup truck, which was their, you know, they don't have armored vehicles or anything, so they use the classic Nissan pickup truck, but they're just full of this equipment. So anti-tank mines, both that they could throw on the roads, but also ones crafted with hooks that they could hook into the IDF tanks and run up and just hook it onto it, or magnet to it. Lots of anti-personnel mines for ambushes that I'll talk about. Lots of kidnap kits, and you can imagine why, which flesh cuffs. They brought food with them in backpacks full of food, like figs, dates, water. They brought their own supplies with them. They had medical kits, like aid bags, with morphine in it. And they also had the drugs that they were taking. Again, I put it in my article to include more that they would take, because many of these were on these drugs that were like psychedelic. But they brought more of it in their kits, more of these drugs to take. So I went into this place where all this equipment that had been captured was laid out, and it was mind blowing, really, just the amount of supplies they brought in. So that, you know, they're basically coming in these waves, attacking, invading, and then they penetrate the fence, like the breach and the penetrate, and they penetrate and head to their objectives. They had targeted objectives. There was no incidental, although if you can look at a map and actually look at a map of red dots, because they're killing along the way. So at this point, you have 22 different breach sites. You have all of these 4,000 forces split up into basically platoons, some squads, kill squads, heading to 20 different sites, all from the very tip of Gaza. If you look at the border of Gaza and Israel, from the very tip, and literally every urban civilian collection of individual locations, from a kibbutz to a village to a town to a city, everyone, 20 of them, just encircling. I don't know if any were left untouched, but literally, if you look at the map, a red dot of a target, and then if you look at a map of actual deaths, it's just a red line, because they were, as people were moving in cars, or as the days started going on, there's just blood on every road, and there's not that many roads to all those 20 different sites. Okay. Once they get to their site, depending on the location, they isolate it. They basically massacre, so deliberate massacre, and I'll talk about that when I talk about one of the sites, which I studied in detail, Faraza. They massacre. Their plan was to stay and hold that terrain. Many of them had maps to advance north to both Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. Some believe that they did want to cause an Arab uprising. They wanted Hezbollah to join them in the north. They wanted the West Bank to uprise. They wanted to reach to mixed communities where there are Arabs and Jews who live side by side. And they wanted to, basically turn neighbor on neighbor, basically, and do really, they had great ambitions for their invasion of Israel. We'll talk about why it didn't happen, but in the end they also had plans to instructions, guidebooks, both on how to kill and how to, although there's no rhyme or reason on who they took hostages, but they're in the process, took over 240 hostages, men, women, children, to include babies, Holocaust survivors, elderly people, everything. So over 240. So let's start with the sites. So one of the sites I wrote about was Faraza, which is a small kibbutz really close. I described the attack. And as somebody who's taught in Ranger School how to do a raid, although again, this wasn't a raid, so this is a deliberate attack. This wasn't a planned withdrawal, but who's taught a raid, I saw every element. So the first wave of the Nukba, who arrived by paragliders, some did to many of the sites, paragliders to Faraza, immediately hit the ground, established security. So they both emplaced snipers, but they send forces all to all the different sites to set up ambushes, like squad to platoon level ambushes on any entry point into the village or the road leading to the other objectives. And I'll talk about that in the response on why anybody who came south, basically southern Israel, had to fight their way there through these ambushes. But when the Nukba hit Faraza, they set up the security, Overwatch, and the snipers know. So in all of these kibbutzes in southern Israel, because of southern Israel and the Gaza envelope, is the security framework is not the same as any normal urban area because of the threat of Gaza, which is there's a lot of past rocket and attacks and everything. The IDF controlled the security situation. But in every kibbutz there, so it's not like every village has a policeman or something like that. They have these village defenders who many of them are designated, and they have armories. And there's some learned lessons here on changes that were made over time with the weapons being in people's houses if they're a part of this community defender force or in an armory. But, you know, just by evolution of policies, many of them, to include Faraza, had all the weapons in an armory, to include helmets and bulletproof vests and weapons. But the Hamas had done a lot of recon, and some believe also with the workers who came from Gaza and worked in these communities, the kibbutzes, to help with the farming and everything, provided that intelligence. So they knew exactly where the armory was, and the sniper's job was to eliminate the people running the men, the defenders of the village who were running to those armories to get weapons to help once they realized they were under attack. The Nukba set up snipers and started taking people down. And at that point, the second wave starts to arrive. The second wave basically deploys kill squads to start massacring the civilians. So this is nothing incidental. This is literally a deliberate attack of the civilian areas. And they had guidebooks. And in their guidebooks, it said crazy things like, take the tires out of the civilians' cars, light the tires on fire, and roll them into the houses. It will not only burn the Jewish people in the houses, but it will also help kill them because it will suffocate them through the smoke. They brought knives in with them to do their massacre. They not only massacred men, women, and children, to include beheadings that are in the video, they killed the dogs, the cows, the chickens. It was bad. But the instruction guidebooks, literally like their handbook of killing, had how to put on the flex cuffs, how to do the killing more viciously. And as these kill squads moved out, there's a bunch of horrific scenes that are in the safe rooms that I talked about. Because again, these safe rooms aren't panic rooms. These safe rooms are bomb shelters. Many of them are, you know, this X room in a house that was actually turned into a nursery or a kid's room, which, as you can see, would lead to a very bad situations here. But also many of these rooms had windows, and they had doors, very thin metal doors without locks. It's literally just a door you shut because it's just a bomb shelter. Or they had no door at all if it was one right outside the house. So you see a lot of images. And one of the reasons we know so much about the attack is that there's so many CCTV cameras on the houses with all the footage, as well as the Hamas version. But these safe rooms become basically sites of carnage because this is where they went to because they thought it was rockets coming before they realized the enemy is at the door. But literally, a Hamas guy is at the door trying to pull open this door without a lock. And you have a mother or a father holding other sides. And I saw a bunch of doors with bullet holes as the Hamas just backed up and just shot through the door until they could kill and get into the door. You have people holding the door shut with bullet holes until they died. And then you had windows where the Hamas are just outside the window shooting in. You have rooms full of everything. But Hamas also, what I forgot to mention as well, Hamas had like these suitcase grenades that were meant to be kind of like form a thermal barrack. This is what I saw when to Erez crossing to the barracks, actually, of the soldiers and the civilian affairs officers, they call COGAT, so much burning was done, like purposely burning, like was something very in that guidebook was really about the burning. So they had these suitcase like little like a handbag like grenades that actually when they deploy, they formed like a thermobaric effect, which if you're non-military, a thermobaric means it sucks the oxygen out of a room and replaces it with fire and causes a very chemical reaction that increases the burn, basically the burning in the room. So these safe rooms were just the scenes of such horrible things. And as the kill squads were going around, no rhyme or reason, you know, house to house or house and then other house, just awful going through the kibbutzim. Then the third wave shows up of basically the scavengers. And Far Oz is real, you know, very strong example, one because of their proximity. So these are people who are crossing this third wave are just, there's a real, near Oz, there's a photo of Palestinians who are now combatants, whether they're Hamas or other people who have gotten the word, again, through the command and control, that Israel has fallen, move, you attack. So you have basically people who may have been civilians that morning who joined in the attack. And there's a real famous photo in near Oz, along the border, along the fence, with just, you know, tens of Palestinian men on bicycles with carts passing through into Israel. And this is that third wave of the scavengers who actually go house to house looking for anything to take. Women's clothes, toys, you know, food, anything, and literally stepping over the massacred individuals and collecting all this stuff to take back into Gaza. As this is happening, of course, they're identifying with no rhyme or reason people to take, and to using that second wave of the reserves to then escort their kidnapped personnel, as their book says, hostages, get them back into Gaza. And then eventually there's the fighting that happens in Far Gaza, which I really, you know, the timing of who shows up when, I have a lot of that on the site, but it gets to really like, you need this, like I saw in Opicum, you need a video documentary of every minute that you have it verified. So it's like thousands of interviews per site to create the, what happened at that one site of the 20 sites. Now move to Erez, which I saw in December as well, which is the Erez humanitarian crossing between Israel and Gaza, in which the Palestinian people of Gaza would come across every day through this, you know, big building that processes everybody with their work cards, basically to cross into Israel to go to work, whether you're a businessman. I think like the individuals there said like 20,000 people a day would cross into Israel for business or work, like laborers. But this was a holiday. So at this site, there were, you know, just 25 of the CLA or the COGAT soldiers and three officers on duty, who in the morning are getting attacked, and there's some videos of Hamas attacking the Erez crossing. But as I walked through this site, it was just, again, more burning just of every individual room of the soldiers' barracks, basically the little, think about like a little fob compared to ours, a Ford outpost with the chews, the containerized housing units, and there's just burning bullet holes, everything, everywhere. And that's what I saw at Erez. So move to Sarot Police Station, which really can become, which is the battle of the Sarot Police Station, which an entire movie can be made about this. So Sarot is one of the bigger cities in southern Israel. I think, you know, if you know my work, you have to have a population of 50,000 usually is the designation of a city. So this is somewhere between a town and a city, I think. But of those waves that we talked about, 6:30 rockets, everybody knows something's going on. By 07 o'clock, Hamas forces had penetrated the border. And four trucks at 07 in the morning hit Sarot. And I actually had hummus in Sarot in December of 2019. But these four trucks show up. Three of the trucks go straight to the police station. Straight, it was just inside the town, the city. It's a city. I think it's a city. I have to look at the numbers. And 27 Hamas members run straight into the station. They fire, again, this is a weekend, low number of police inside. I think the total number of 10 to 15. They fire an RPG at the front desk and overtake and quickly move into the station. So 27 Hamas members of these street trucks. There's a short battle inside the building. Five of the police get onto the roof. And we'll talk about the building, but a very big, strong police station. Five of the police are on the roof, but they're also on this roof, which is kind of segregated, has sections with a Hamas sniper who moved to the roof as well to set up overwatch on top of the building. By 7:00, really, in the timing because of the CCTV videos, there is the Southern District Police Chief lives in the city and is at the police station outside of it within 10 minutes. His name was Amir Cohen. And he knows there are police on the roof because they're signaling to him. And he knows there's a sniper up there and he's taking fire. That's about the extent he knows. And there's a short engagement with him. And all he has is his handgun. He actually seeks refuge behind a plastic, like a recycling bin. He takes two rounds to the back from ricocheted off the walls. And he's behind this thing taking cover. Now he's wounded. And he calls the Magav district station. Magav, if you don't know, is basically the gendarmerie, or the kind of like the police / military force that is IDF. Like a military ID police type force, basically. Anyways, they get called. They arrive very quickly. All that Amir Cohen is able to tell them is that they think there's 3 to 4 terrorists inside and a sniper on the roof. But this is the story of course, the response is that you have other people showing up who are off-duty security forces from like every part of the Israel security forces, from police, intelligence like Shin Bet or counterterrorism services like the Yamam. And then one of the people who show up who lives in Afikim as well is a Yamam sniper who gets a long rifle from somebody there and gets in the building opposite of the police station and takes out the Hamas sniper on the roof just using the iron sights. And there's actually bullet holes where the sniper's trying to shoot him and he takes the sniper out. So this basically starts the battle. So more Magav show up, and then the battle of the Sarot police station is happening. It continues. The Magav try to move into the police station, make it inside, and face stiff resistance. And actually, one of the guys gets trapped, and they have to use a grenade to get him out. The Imam show up and form the perimeter for the Magav, basically the attack of the police station. At one point, a fire truck gets brought in, and they're able to get 3 of the 5 police off the roof. And then they tried to do, if you know military operations, a squeegee. They try to go from the top using the fire truck down the police station to clear it from top to down, which is an effective, close-quarter battle technique. But they use a drone and figure out that the Hamas terrorists are, there's many of them to include in the police in the stairwell. So it doesn't work. So then they try to use a Matador anti-tank weapon to form a breach into the wall. Doesn't work. Later they bring in a tank, use tank rounds. Doesn't work. Because this is one of the stories of the police stations too, is this police station was built so strongly that it was like a textbook strong point in a military term, where you have a building that's a reinforced steel, reinforced concrete building of immense strength that you can defend. And that's what you did. And that's what Hamas did. Around 5 p.m. that day, so literally started at 7 in the morning, around 5 p.m. that day, Hamas tries to break out of this police station. And that's when they realized that it's more than three or four terrorists in this police station. And there's, you know, over 20, as they can tell from how many are trying to break out of the police station. And at one, you know, at one point, the district commander gives the order to destroy the building through fires, you know, aerial fires. But then he rescinds it, which is interesting. Later, next morning, they have a bulldozer on site. Basically, the battle concludes. The 10 police were killed, but one was actually found in that last moment as the bulldozer is collapsing, you know, penetrating into the building. Okay. Afakum, which is one of the towns, which is the farthest east that Hamas penetrated, 07 in the morning, two trucks of 17 Hamas hit the city. Now, like I said, there is a debate on whether they missed a turn and were supposed to hit the police station, just like what I just talked about in Sirot, to take down the minimum number of forces that were left on the holiday. But there's also a belief that, no, they for some reason that wasn't the plan. They meant to go straight into the city because it seemed very deliberate. The two trucks hit the city. They killed the first victim at 7:02. And they immediately deploy from their pickup trucks and start walking down the street looking for people to kill. And then the rhyme or reason of what they're doing doesn't make sense, but they're moving into the city, town, village, and just shooting everybody. There's a bunch of incidents where the people, not understanding what's going on, of course they knew about the rockets and they were trying to get into the bomb shelters, and they thought that, you know, the people with, you know, vests on and AK-40s, they thought they were IDF, and there's some unfortunate deaths that happened, like where they thought they were IDF initially, and it ended up being, you know, it's a Hamas terrorist walking down the street killing everybody. About 7:21, the Hamas take a house. And it turns into this long, like, hostage situation with two elderly people, which we'll talk about towards the end. At one point, there's also three terrorists that take this house, and there's a kind of a rental room on the backside of the house. The three terrorists go in there, and for 90 minutes are just inside this room eating and taking drugs. And the CCTV camera, and then there's an elderly lady who I met and sat and had coffee with, who's calling in, like, they're outside my house. She's communicating where they are. At one point later, so the first squad car shows up at 7:25 to Afakum. You know, I didn't mention it. The other part of this was the overloading the system, just like Mumbai. Because most city systems, when they have a 911 call center, if it gets overloaded, well, this is the case. I don't know if it's in most systems. I don't think I asked that question, even though I've interviewed police chiefs and everything, but I'm pretty sure it's like this. A call center, if it gets overloaded, the calls are routed to a different city. So you can imagine what's going on October 7th. Everybody's blinded. Nobody knows what's going on. There's actually videos from many of the attack scenes now being put on national, on the Israeli TV, straight from users who are just sending it in to different people, and it's going straight on the news. The 911 calls are 100 for Israel. They're going to Jerusalem and Tel Aviv because they overloaded immediately. Thousands of calls are coming into the call centers of southern Israel, so they're blinded. So in Afakum, you know, it's basically people calling people and saying that something's going on here. They're shooting. But the first police car, squad car, arrives at 7:25. There's a situation with a policeman that runs into a bomb shelter. One grenade thrown in, he kicks it out. Two grenades thrown in, he kicks it out. Third grenade explodes, he still survived. I actually met him. There, what's interesting about Afakum, there's a lot of off-duty police. There's some subsidies in the city, but there's a lot of off-duty police who show up and are part of these fights. There's a Shin Bet guy, a Dudavant guy, that are all engaging, But anyways, that at that house I was telling you about where the three terrorists are, the police show up because they had been communicating with the homeowner. And there's in the video, it's really crazy that you see the police try to walk up to that room in which these guys are just hanging out. And then there's the cloth, like shelter that's set up on the outside of people's houses. And I'm sorry, I don't have the name of it. And there's a situation where the police, the terrorist walks out of that room and they're face to face. And the police go to shoot him and his rifle misfires. And in the video, you see the police running out of the house as he just misfired his weapon face to face with the Hamas member. And what's also fascinating is that the people sitting outside don't shoot him as he literally trips and falls over himself trying to get out, and he actually doesn't get, the Hamas guy doesn't shoot him. Later, that one house where I told you there was kind of a kidnap situation, that's the like the final fight that happens as around 1:30 that fight happens, and they actually clear the house, and there's a guy who gets found after the house is cleared hiding in a closet. Let's go to Nova Music Festival, because interestingly, the police chief of the Officum police station is the head of security at the Nova Music Festival, because the Nova Music Festival is something that happens every year. There's a permission that gets put in. The police and the IDF provide security. You think about any concert or anything. At the Nova Music Festival, there's 3,000 tickets sold and 400 staff. So 3,400 people are at this festival in southern Israel near a place called Riem. But it's an outdoor Nova, you know, a music festival with these giant like circus tents set up. It actually starts on Thursday night, bleeds into Friday. October 7th is a Saturday morning. I interviewed the Officum police chief who said he was on the ground. They actually at the daybreak, so they're waiting for the sun to come up, and the music has started. He actually asked for a video to be taken, and he had that video, a drone video of the overall area, because he was taking notes, you know, things to do next year, like any commander or leader does. He's already thinking about the lessons and the changes and things like that. So he asked for this overflight to be done. Well, at 6:27, he's standing there in the rockets, and he immediately recognizes that's not one. They're very close to Gaza. Recognizes that's not even if it was not normal. He immediately makes up the call that the festival is over. Goes up to the DJ station and says, "Party's over. Evacuate. Basically, leave." He orders six of his police to go out into the parking lot because there's 2,500 cars in the parking lot. Six police to go out to the cars to take the fences down that are kind of barricading all the cars in, normal stuff. Tell them to take those down so there's a funnel, basically, as people are trying to get out, as there's no shelter to go to, right? There's no bomb shelter. So he made this call to evacuate, thinking that that was the threat. So from basically 6:30 to 8 o'clock, people are getting out. They're moving by car out, and they're moving from southern Israel north. The chief actually leaves because he thinks that that's it. He goes to the police station, and he arrives there later, and that's a kind of a different story. But the story of Nova Music Festival is that you have thousands of people that are now trying to drive north, many of them between 6:30 and 7:45-ish, pass, don't see Hamas, and pass on. But if you, again, all these different villages are being hit. There's one near the music festival called Beheri, Kibbutz Beheri, where Hamas has entered and started their killing, sees that there's all these cars heading north. They go out to the road and start killing anybody driving in the roads. And there's lots of the videos in that October 7th video that I watched. It's actually from that scene of them coming out onto the highway and just starting to shoot all these cars with RPGs and AK-47s. Many of the civilians that are you know, that this is happening, turn around, U-turn, head back to Nova Music Festival. Get back there, tell the police that are there helping with the traffic that Hamas is doing this. Six of those policemen set up a blocking position. Ten Hamas trucks head from Barry south. So they came from Barry south towards the music festival. That police blocking point is set up. Basically, there's a photo of them with their handguns standing there. Hamas show up. Hamas shoot RPGs at them and kills all six of those police. And then Hamas basically arrives at the music festival and starts massacring hundreds, literally hundreds of the people that are still there. There was an issue with, the people that are still there. There's one scene where the police just hide under the one of the main, where the DJ station was underneath there. Hamas fired RPGs at that and killed a lot just in that one spot. But there's also a situation, which is in the video, where the Hamas show up and the kids start running through the dirt field, and there's actually a machine gun that opens up and you can hear it from the Hamas. And I was wondering why they were heading to that field, but there was actually a dirt creek bed. That if you got to the creek bed, you could walk the creek bed and head in towards Afikom. But there's just scene after scene of young Israeli kids, basically teenagers, hiding in trash cans, hiding in the Porta Johns, and the GoPro shows the Hamas just lighting up the Porta Johns. And then you see the next photo is just dead people and blood, dead in the Porta Johns. And that's, you know, part of the, and then they just keep killing anybody they can. It's a massacre. There are people showing up. So this gets into the response of what stops Hamas. If you understand, the IDF has been blinded or all killed. In southern Israel, the Gaza station, a brigade commander is killed within the very first fight at that division headquarters. The police stations are attacked. Most of the response are individual off-duty or just civilians who know something are going on and head south. And that's the story of, for many, many hours, of either in the communities or just got in a car and headed south. And there's so many of those stories, and I'll be picking out a few when I go to write about it, kind of like I did the Battle of Kyiv. And like, if you've ever seen the movie Hotel Mumbai, it tells you actually three different location stories in one hotel, although there's two hotels that were held and actually a Jewish Chabad and a police station in Mumbai. But the way the movie's told, it's all in one scene because they took stories from heroes or people that saved other people and then put it into one hotel just for the movie. There's going to be hundreds of those stories, and many of those stories have been, if you go looking for them, they're there. One of the ones that really fascinated me was, because I had been to southern Israel, there's a place called the Black Arrow. It's the Black Arrow Monument. It's real famous. If you look it up on a map. There's a situation here where there's, at that Black Arrow, a very important spot, a group of Yamam, which is the counterterrorism police. Like, and if you go back to my podcast, The Mother's Bus, you'll get a kind of an overview on what the Yamam are, but it's basically our version of the national counterterrorism force. Some really high speed, hardcore guys show up to the Black Arrow, and they see a giant convoy of Hamas trucks. That second wave or first wave had already penetrated into Israel and were headed to the Black Arrow onto the highway and headed north. And there's a massive firefight. So for me, it's like the hot gates of southern Israel, like this one point by happenstance. It wasn't planned, where these few Yamam members hold off 40. Is what the number was given, 40 trucks of Hamas in a convoy headed to penetrate and hit some, you know, hit north, head to the north, as like I said, the maps were there. A lot of the Yamam fell at that location, but they did not penetrate that point. So it's like the hot gates of Thermopylae, you know, some other amazing stand. As a matter of fact, the Yamam have only lost 10, you know, soldiers, if you want to call them soldiers, in their entire history, but they lost 8 on October 7th. So they had only lost 10 in their entire history from the 1970s, 80s until now, and they lost 8 on October 7th. So then you do have, of course, the different military reserve units that are self-mobilizing and heading south, and there's a real famous, I call it famous, but a situation where an all-male tank team, all-female tank team led by a hardcore female tank commander heads south and enter one of the kibbutzes. And really all the interviews I did is that once a tank showed up, everything changed because, you know, yes, terrorist AK-47 RPG is better than the situation where you had lots of fights with 9mm handguns versus RPG. But when a tank shows up, everything changed. So you see the military arriving later in the day because they have to fight through these ambushes that are there to get there. And that really leads into the next morning, when the fights continue. The Sirot battle is not even over until the morning of October 8th. And really understanding what's going on, you can imagine the chaos, the incomplete chaos in a country the size of New Jersey. Oh, by the way, on October 8th, the morning of, Hezbollah starts attacking with rockets in the north. So the chaos on chaos on chaos. On October 7th. In total, there were over 1,200 Israeli killed on October 7th and about 240 hostages taken into Gaza. The IDF and the Israeli police and all of the people who fought back and stopped this from being, though it was the worst you could ever imagine. But I honestly, as a researcher, believe that it was Hamas wanted it to be much, much bigger, this invasion, the death, and the how much it achieved. They wanted it to be much more. But it was stopped by just people fighting back and saying, not, no. And so many acts of sacrifice that you can see in all these different stories, whether they're policemen or just former, you know, 70-year-old generals getting in their car, heading south and self-organizing. There's one of the division commanders that I walked Khan Yunis with had headed south and was self-organizing around the Nova Music Festival. Anybody who showed up and was directing, just another amazing story. But the IDF, the police, all these, they killed about 1,000 of the Hamas terrorist military personnel inside of Israel territory and captured about another 200. And that's what I've got so far on October 7th. I plan to study it more. Another big part of the story is these kibbutz defenders, this ideal that, you know, I've researched as well, in Ukraine and other places, that the community rises up and fights back to include these kibbutz, despite what Hamas recons try to do to stop these kibbutz security forces, or these, you know, Minutemen almost. That's another big lesson out of this, is how effective they were at stopping despite the overwhelming attack, how effective they were in stopping it. So that's a big part of the lesson, and what's going to be done. Of course, there'll be a massive study on how October 7th happened. I'm studying what happened, not how it happened, like what are the actual actions that happened. Hopefully this gives people a better understanding, because I don't think it's really out there. because of how many people were involved, how big the attack was, the fact that the war started immediately, that Hezbollah started sending hundreds of rockets to this day. There are still, so some of the Sarot was actually about 2 weeks ago reoccupied the city. Like one, actually the day that I was there, it was like a day before or two before they allowed civilians to go back. But at one point there were over 100,000 Israeli civilians evacuated from southern and northern Israel. There's still 80,000 in northern Israel who I also toured there, can't move back. But tens of thousands in southern that can't move back either. They're all staying in hotels with families, kids in different schools and all of that. But that's part of this, the story of October 7th as well. Like I'm really trying to gather the actions from an urban warfare perspective, like I've studied the Mumbai attacks, but this is actually a full military division level invasion attack with many elements of civil, military, civilian security forces resisting in what's called total defense. And even by the design of some of the locations of these spots, that was some of the design, especially in the north. But I will keep researching it. I hope it helped everybody understand a little bit more what happened that day. Thanks for listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast. The podcast is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of their participants and do not represent the positions of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. You can subscribe to the Urban Warfare Project podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. And be sure to check out NWI's other podcasts, as well as the new articles we're publishing every day on our website. Thanks again for listening.